Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast with me, Guy Foster, speaking to James Ashley, a strategist at Goldman Sachs, is not intended as investment advice. But bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Brew and Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned. When investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. With those things said, please enjoy the following Brewin podcast. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another Brewin podcast with me, Guy Foster, the head of research here at Brewin Dolphin. And I'm very pleased to be joined for this podcast by James Ashley, who is the head of international market strategy at Goldman Sachs Asset Management. So, James, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, as I say, for joining us. We're going to start by just discussing your sort of general view of how things have developed. The market obviously fell very fast as the full extent of the coronavirus became known. And then it's recovered pretty fast as well. More recently, the momentum seems to be just becoming a bit more ambiguous. So what do you think the outlook is for risky assets like stocks from this point?
Yeah, I mean, if you look, let's use US equities as a bellwether, obviously, by far from being the be-all and end-all, but let's just use that as a starting point. I think US equities sold off by about 34% between mid-Feb and mid-March. There was then a rally of about 30% until mid-April. And then, as you said, since mid-April, we've basically traded sideways. Where we are today is pretty much where we were a month ago. Now, that rally that we saw up until mid-April, I think, wasn't so much driven by the macro data. The macro data were coming out consistently weaker than the market had been expecting. But it was in response to two things. I think first and foremost, the medical situation and the fact that it appears and appeared at that point in time also that the curves were beginning to flatten and one or two economies were talking about initiating the first phase of their exit strategy. And I think in addition to that, perhaps the most powerful reason for that rally was policy. You saw this super aggressive response from policymakers, not just monetary policy, but also fiscal policy, regulatory policy, and so on, but certainly monetary policy in the vanguard of that. And I think that's really what turbocharged that rally. So on a forward-looking basis, when we get to the valuations we're at today, I look and I say, well, look, if the fundamentals are going to be as challenged and as difficult as we expect them to be, not just for a few weeks, but perhaps for a few months, at these sorts of valuations, given how supportive policy is, I wouldn't expect necessarily a major step back in terms of where the market is, but the upside is somewhat limited. So when I look at, say, US equities, I'd be broadly neutral at these sorts of valuations. And now on a risk-adjusted basis, I would certainly see more potential for a slight downside move than I would a material leg higher given where we are today. But I should emphasize, I think we are well beyond the low points of this cycle. I don't think we go back and retest the lows that we saw in mid-March, but I do think there's some scope, perhaps a step backwards, before we then see a more measured and sustainable move higher.
Well, that's really interesting, James, because I guess if you look back at previous sell-offs, it would be very unusual to reach the low for a bear market so very quickly indeed. But I wonder, is it the fact that this recession, the recession that's obviously driving this sell-off, is unusually self-induced? Is that what makes this a different, like a dramatically different situation to the ones that we've seen before? And is that maybe why you think that it's less likely that we retest those lows again?
I think the current situation we are in, I mean, the word unprecedented is overused in markets, but I think this genuinely is unprecedented in a number of dimensions. One of those dimensions is how quickly this happened. You know, you think about where we were just in the first half of March, and most of Europe and the US was operating business as usual. There were some disruptions to supply chains because obviously coronavirus was affecting China and large parts of Asia. But from a European and US perspective, it was really only in the latter part of March that we started to see significant disruption to domestic activity. So it's unusual in that sense, and equally unusual in response to the violence of the drawdown that we've seen in markets, how quickly and how far they've fallen. policy makers deserve a lot of credit, I think, for moving so rapidly to counteract that. So again, let's stick with the US because that's where we started the conversation. But if you look at what the Fed was doing at the height of QE purchases during the global financial crisis, they were running at about $120 billion of treasury purchases per month. At the start of this crisis, they were purchasing $75 billion per day. And that's tapered down, but it tells you something about how muscular, how forceful, how front-loaded has the policy response been. And I think if you look at the language from policymakers right now, the comments from Jerome Powell that we had, I think, just yesterday, the mood music coming out of the Bank of England, it's very clear that I think policymakers, not just in central banks, but more generally, are saying, we're willing to do more. If we need to do more, we will do more. And in that sense, even though the macro data, as I've said, I think will remain challenged, I think it's going to take a long time before we get back to the level of activity we had just 2 or 3 months ago. I think as long as policy remains very, very supportive, as it appears to be doing, then we're not going to go back to those lows that we saw in mid-March.
So, interesting that you should mention the policy response there, and particularly the comments from the Bank of England. I think the governor did an interview with ITV just before we record this podcast, and in it he talked about the bank. He seemed to talk about the bank being able to spread the cost of the current crisis over a longer period of time. Now, obviously, debt financing of government spending spreads the cost over a longer period of time. So what the central bank can do is beginning to sound a bit more like explicitly funding government spending. Is that the way you would understand what he's talking about? And if so, do you think that's going to have longer term market implications?
Well, what he also said in the interview, if I recall it correctly, was that the independence and the credibility of the central bank is crucial to the extent that they continue to do that. Yeah. So if the market starts to say, this is quite clearly monetary financing, then at that point you start to question whether the central bank is truly independent. And at that point you start to say, well, if I'm going to hold a given asset from a given country, I want some compensation for that because I can no longer have faith that the central bank is going to behave in a rational, predictable manner. So I think the Bank of England, like every other central bank out there, is clearly operating in closer harmony with other authorities, fiscal included, but I still think the central banks are jealously guarding their independence. Now, what you're seeing at the moment is that what central banks are doing, let's use the Bank of England in this case, is doing very aggressive QE, but that is justifiable in that it's in response to weak nominal demand and therefore a weak outlook for inflation. So we're doing QE because we need to boost inflation. That's our legal mandate. Now, clearly, one of the consequences of that, one of the direct consequences of that, is to suppress yields, which means that the government then can issue debt, BMO on behalf of the government, I should say more accurately, can issue debt without yields spiking significantly higher because you have the Bank of England there in the background suppressing them. But I should emphasize that is a means to an end. That is not the end in itself. So it's just the way that QE works is to suppress those yields, and that allows easier cost of financing, and that in turn boosts nominal demand, and that in turn boosts inflation. So I think what the Bank of England and what many other central banks are doing is absolutely supportive of government policy. It is absolutely supportive of fiscal policy being more pro-cyclical and more aggressive. But I don't think for the moment that that is a direct intention of policy. It's simply a byproduct, albeit a very significant and very obvious byproduct of what they're doing.
And so in a year's time or a couple of years' time, if you start to have inflation coming back and government spending still quite rampant, or the still relatively large government deficit, then the bank no longer has that justification for aggressive quantitative easing. So under those circumstances, would you expect that to have quite significant market implications on things like long-term interest rates?
Yeah, that's the scenario you just sketched out there. There would be, I think, very little justification for continued QE. If you take it a step further and say, well, okay, is there then an argument for saying there should be some tightening of monetary policy? Should rates be moving higher? That's where I think you start to see the acid test of whether or not central bank independence has been compromised. Have we moved into a world in which there is fiscal dominance? So, you know, think about what fiscal dominance might look like. There are many ways that that could happen. But one is to say that as a result of this crisis, and of course the legacy of the global financial crisis, which is yet to be purged, but those two combined, we've now moved into a world in which there's much higher levels of debt in the economy. And as rates start to move higher, that means that more and more resources get devoted to debt servicing costs, whether it's you and me paying our mortgages or whether it's the government financing the gilt bill. Either way, more and more is being devoted to debt servicing rather than to consumption or to investment. And then think about what the central bank is trying to do. They're trying to manage nominal demand, the overall level of nominal demand, in order to steer inflation in the right direction. So if they believe that the high level of debt in the economy means there's a very high level of sensitivity to interest rates, then as a consequence, they've got to be very, very cautious about raising rates. In other words, the extraordinary levels of debt that are being introduced right now significantly hamper and impair the ability of central banks to raise rates in the future. And that's where you can start to say, well, what governments are doing today might not be, if you like, facilitated or driven by what central banks are doing today, but it certainly has implications for what central banks might do tomorrow. And I think that in turn will have implications for where you can see the yield curve moving, perhaps long end of it. When you look at where yields are today, is perhaps vulnerable. You know, if we think about what is going to happen once all of the support is out of the way from central banks, and that's not anytime soon, but once it is, and the market has to stand on its own 2 feet, and we start looking at fiscal dynamics once again, then I start to say, do fixed income valuations today look sustainable without the support that's coming through on an ongoing basis from central banks? And I start to say, I'm not sure that these valuations, they are truly supported. And that's why over a medium to long-term horizon, I still think that equities will outperform rates.
We talked about the central bank response, I think, very much in terms of the size of the response. But one thing that has differed with this over the last few weeks or month or so has not just been the size, but also the breadth. I mean, there's now more explicit discussion about central banks participating in primary markets rather than just secondary markets. And although we had seen it in probably most regions already, more explicit discussion of and more explicit plans to participate in corporate markets and in some cases in corporate primary markets. So do those kind of things change the market outlook?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why you think it. So I've just expressed the view that I think over the medium-term horizon, equities are likely to outperform rates. But I emphasize over the medium-term horizon. Go back to what I said earlier, that I think right now, given where equity market valuations have got to, there's perhaps a bit more downside than there is upside on a tactical horizon. So if you're thinking on a tactical basis, how do we position? Well, first and foremost, let's just be clear that there's so much uncertainty out there, not just the usual macro and market uncertainty, but all of that being predicated on a level of medical uncertainty that none of us, no one anywhere ever has had to deal with before. Let's just be a bit hesitant before we start to make very large tactical positions. So I think the hurdle for being tactical has got to be significantly higher. That said, you will still see some appetite for taking some tactical positions. And if I'm not so confident about equity markets on a tactical horizon, where I do have a bit more confidence is thinking about credit markets. If I look at where particularly high quality credits, investment grade credit markets are right now, we saw this massive spread decompression at the same time that equity markets were selling off. We've then seen some retracements of that, so spreads have come back in quite significantly. But I still think there's further to go in that, particularly because, as you said, you're now seeing central banks not just intervening through government bond markets, but you're seeing increasingly support coming in to corporate credit markets as well. And that's both direct support, so schemes that might be set up to purchase commercial paper or to allow purchase of corporate bonds, but also the indirect ripple effects from QE. Now, think about how QE works. The idea is to suppress yields to such low levels that you and I say, well, I'm not going to buy any gilts or any treasuries at these sorts of levels. So we'll go and buy something that's pretty similar in terms of risk return profile. And the nearest thing you might conclude is appropriate might be high quality investment grade credit. So the ripple effect, forcing private sector money out of the government bond market and into other parts of the universe, is also beneficial for corporate credit markets. So to reiterate, I'd be cautious about taking large tactical positions right now, but to the extent that there is some tactical opportunity, I think one of those opportunities is in high quality corporate credit markets. And partly that you can trace that back to the policy actions, not just of central banks, but also ministries of finance.
You mentioned high quality credit there. You presumably are worried about defaults then in the lower quality part of the credit markets, where there's also ostensibly quite a lot of value apparent.
Yeah, I think if you're going down to, I mean, obviously you can talk about lower quality investment grade issuers, but let's just take it all the way to the extreme of the lowest quality high yield issuers. We are in a world in which the economy is going to take a long time to recover. I think I've said that explicitly already, that we will start to see a rebound in Q3, hopefully, but the time it will take to fully recover the ground that's been lost as a result of this crisis will be several quarters. So if you're a company who came into this with a shaky balance sheet, going to go through a very deep, albeit hopefully short recession, and even once we're out of recession, the time it takes to recover could be quite prolonged, then there's a question about whether your business is going to survive. And that's before you then start to think about sector-specific dynamics, things that might be related to the oil price collapsing or similar changes that might have been underway already, things like the retail sector being impacted by the rise of online purchases. So I think if you're looking at weaker balance sheets, they're going to come under stress as a result of this. And therefore, yes, the yields might be more attractive, but I think we are going to see a significant pickup in defaults in the lower quality end of credit markets. So that's why I say the risk reward just doesn't look attractive. I think you're going to see a lot more risk. And although the yields might look attractive right now, I think over the next few weeks, months, and quarters ahead, that could be a very dangerous place to be.
Okay, and one of the things that's been really dramatic has been the relative performance of different parts of the equity market, and you kind of alluded to it slightly there. But with things like growth, the kind of growth style of company outperforming the value style so dramatically, now we're beginning to see observations that perhaps this has gone too far, and yet at the same time, obviously that many of the constituents of the value equity universe are the companies that are finding this lockdown more difficult. So do you have a preference for where the best opportunities are within that spectrum?
Honestly, no, I don't have a strong bias either way. I struggle with that kind of dichotomy. I mean, it's a question we get a lot, so it's a fair, legitimate question. But I think you need to be thinking about not so much whether this is a growthy type company or a valuey type company, but just more about what is its business model? How nimble is the management going to be in terms of adapting to rapidly changing economic circumstances? What's the quality of its balance sheet? So obviously valuations become a part of that, and just thinking about, you know, what's the near-term momentum and trajectory. But I think it's more about, is this a company that can adapt to a new world? I think coronavirus will have not just temporary implications, but it'll have profound long-term implications for some sectors. Some good, some bad, of course. But I think it's less about let's be growth, let's be value-oriented. It's more about thinking about each company individually and saying, is this a company that we want to be owning in our portfolio, irrespective of which bucket it happens to fall into? So I guess what I'm arguing is it's less about being growth or value biased. It's more about, I think, an active environment. This isn't the environment where I think it pays to be passive and just be riding the beta of markets. I think this is very much a stock picker's market where you need to be very much mindful of what individual company, irrespective of what sector it's in or what country it happens to be based in, what's the outlook for each individual name that you are holding in your portfolio.
And one of the things that has been presumably a very meaningful support for the US equity market, which has been such a strong performer over so many years, has been the demand that's come from US companies themselves buying back shares. We have to assume that there's going to be a distinct absence of that over the coming 12 months or so. And even there are some stories now about obviously the need for sovereign wealth funds to liquidate some of their positions as well. So do you see this kind of technical pressure being a major hurdle for the market?
I think it's going to become less positive, let's put it in those terms. But I think it's not just that. It's also, I mean, I think it's the point I'm about to make is related to that, but slightly separate. And that's to think about how economic incentives have changed from a corporate perspective. So the companies that survive this crisis, the ones that come out the other side of it, they're presumably, in many cases, going to come out with much higher levels of debt. And then number one priority, therefore, might no longer be about investing for the future or hiring new workers or growing market share. It might be about deleveraging. Because if there is a second wave of infections, or if there's a further separate unrelated crisis a year, 2 years, 3 years hence, we need to make sure that our balance sheet is sufficiently robust in order to be able to withstand that. And as a consequence, behavior is going to change. It's no longer about maximizing return on equity. It's making sure that your balance sheet is sufficiently robust so that you're still standing after the next crisis.
Okay, look, I want to broaden things out a bit. One of the things that I think has been garnering increasing news and anxiety amongst investors is the relationship between the US and China, which has obviously been fairly fraught in recent years, looked to be thawing last year, but in the last few weeks seems to have become frostier still, and I wonder what you expect, or how you expect this to impact the market going forwards.
Yeah, so let's zoom out and just think about the secular change, and then we can zoom right back in and think about the specifics of here and now. The secular change that was happening prior to coronavirus, and the thing that we've been seeing evolve rapidly over the past 20 or 30 years, is the emergence of China. You know, China today is around 20% of global GDP on a PPP basis. And if you compare that to the US is somewhere around 15, 16%. So depending on how you prefer to measure it, China is now either larger than the US in terms, or it's clearly the second largest. But certainly it's an economic challenger to the US's supremacy in economic terms. That is yet to be translated through to geopolitical influence, military influence, and so on. But I think China is saying, look, we are evolving into a situation where our economic might requires us to have more significant global influence. And so therefore, the primacy, the supremacy of the US that we've seen really since the demise of the USSR at the start of the 90s is now being challenged in a way that perhaps hasn't been for 30 years. So there's been a secular change here. We're moving from a unipolar world to one in which we have two huge behemoths sort of dominating the geopolitical and economic landscape. So there's a secular change that's at play there. Of course, the US, not just under President Trump, but also I think under President Obama prior to that, is trying to defend its interests in a variety of possible ways. And most recently, that of course has been through the initiation of trade wars. Now, that trade conflict, as you said, so zooming back in now to the specifics on the ground, that trade conflict had taken a step forward. There had been a phase one trade deal signed at the start of this year, so there was some de-escalation of tensions, but it was a long, long way from being resolved. And I think you would have been frightfully optimistic to think that a full comprehensive trade deal would have been signed before the US election in November. Possible, of course, but I think it would be very optimistic to assume that that would, of course, have happened. So we were already seeing a year ahead of us where we were expecting continued tensions between the US and China and geopolitical uncertainties. And that in its current manifestation relates to trade wars. But again, if you think about that bigger term context, it was really about this secular change where China is now becoming, you know, a true global leader, a true global player. It's challenging the US in many dimensions the US hasn't been challenged in recent years gone by. So for investors, what does that mean? I think it means you should expect geopolitics to continue to be a source of uncertainty and probably spikes in volatility coming on the back of that, not just over the course of this year leading into the US election, but I think over the years to come, probably over the decades to come, that will remain a source of uncertainty and volatility. And then the challenge for investors is to think of that associated volatility not so much as a risk, something that can do damage to their portfolios, but something that generates opportunities. How do you take advantage of the dislocations and the rapid market movements that might come in response to a given spike in volatility?
Thinking about, so just finally, I think, just thinking about the nearer term future, we've obviously got this election coming up later this year in November in the US, of course. And you've got a couple of characters here, President Trump and former Vice President Biden, contesting it. One, the Democrat Biden is associated with perhaps a calmer and more experienced hand, but at the same time, tax increases potentially. The other, President Trump, is obviously delivered significant tax cuts to the US economy. But at the same time, he seems to fan these flames, which can be quite disruptive to the market. So which of these candidates do you think is the preferred one from an investor's perspective?
Yeah, look, I should be completely clear at the outset here that neither I nor GSAM have any desire whatsoever to express a political preference on our behalf. But in terms of your question, I think is fair that you're asking from the market's perspective, you know, how might the market respond to very, very different presidents, both in terms of personality and substance. I think the first point to note is that the market will probably be less challenged by either Biden or Trump than it would have been perhaps by some of the more radical Democrat candidates who are no longer in the race. So while there are certainly a number of clear differences, some of which you've just articulated, both in terms of personality and policy platforms between Biden and Trump, the choice that's going to be available to American voters in November won't be quite as stark as it might otherwise have been. Now, if you look at the betting markets right now, the presidential race is a toss-up. It's about 50-50. So I think it's premature to take a strong view on the outcome at this stage, particularly given the COVID impact. I suspect one of the key determinants of whether or not Trump is re-elected is how quickly and how far the economy bounces back over the next few months. So to borrow a phrase from Clinton's campaign in 92, is the economy stupid? But what does seem clear is whether we get Trump 2.0 or whether we get Biden, whoever is in charge in the US for the next 4 years will inherit an ideologically disparate Congress that is going to be challenging, I think, advance any major legislation outside of the reconciliation process. And what that means for things like you mentioned tax, think about things like tax that has to go through Congress. And unless you have a unified Congress where the President, the Senate, and the House are all blue or all red, then it's very difficult to get major changes through. So that's not to say that the presidency is irrelevant. Clearly, there's going to be a huge difference between if you have a Trump presidency or a Biden presidency. But if you're thinking about how the market is likely to react, nothing the market is going to react just to who wins the White House. It's going to be very much about the configuration of what does Congress look like in its entirety. And those same betting markets that I've just said are saying it's about 50-50 whether or not it's Trump or Biden who wins the White House. They're saying quite clearly that at the moment, it looks as though we are going to have a divided Congress. So absolutely, this is something that I think is going to become more and more relevant to the market as we go through the summer. Hopefully, the coronavirus situation stops being quite such an intense headwind from a market perspective, and we can start to think about other things. I'm not sure whether that will be the case or not, but let's hope that is the case, that the situation there starts to improve. I think in that environment, the market will focus certainly on the presidential race, but crucially, I think it's also going to be very much driven by the race for Congress as well and how that is shaping up.
Okay, James, well, I think that's probably all that we've got time for on this podcast. It's been a really helpful overview of everything that you're seeing at the moment. So thanks very much to you, James, for that overview. And thanks very much as well to all of our viewers for tuning in. We hope you join us again on the next Bruin podcast.